and welcome to another episode of LedgerCast. This one's going to look a little bit different to those of you who are watching via YouTube because I am live with Derek Walchek. Hey, Derek.
Hello.
Y'all don't know who Derek is yet, maybe, but you will. Derek and I are actually going to be working on some collaborative projects and interviews together. So I wanted to take advantage of today to introduce the rest of the LedgerCast audience to you. We've gotten to know each other over the past, I don't know, 3 or 4 months, mm-hmm. something like that. You are here in Alabama, where I'm also based, and I don't exactly remember how we got connected, but
somebody hooked us up on Twitter. I think somebody noticed a tweet that I had tweeted and said, "Hey, there's another Alabama guy here." And yeah, he hooked us up. Was that Rick?
Yeah, I think it was Rick.
Yeah.
So
thanks, Rick.
Appreciate that, Rick. So ever since we've been chatting in Telegram and then met up for lunch and stuff a few times and just gotten to know one another. And like, it's nice to have someone locally that you can talk to about crypto
or cry too,
or cry depending on the state of the market.
That's right.
So
got together,
we're addressing the market in pretty different ways. And what I was excited about was that you bring so much to the table, both in terms of real life experience as an investor, and you know, you run your business. Those of you watching on YouTube notice Derek's wearing the coat jacket, so he's official.
Why wouldn't I?
Yeah. So and you know,
when I make a bunch of money, I'll start wearing t-shirts between 8 and 3.
I think that's a fallacy. don't get the wrong idea here that me being in a t-shirt.
He's got all the crypto you could ever want.
Yeah. No. I'm super poor. Haven't you seen the market?
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I've addressed the space mostly in the sense of, you know, drop some money in and start trading. And I look at charts and I do some fundamental analysis, but you're taking that really the next level because you're not only doing trading and you've kind of approached the ecosystem from a lot of perspectives. And I want to learn about that. But you're also doing a lot of ICO investing and talking to the teams behind these. Mm-hmm. So that's my short introduction for you. But I want to get your story of like, let's step back a notch before we get back to here and say, okay, well, how did you even learn about crypto and get into this space coming from your real estate background?
Okay. So I'll try to be as concise as I possibly can be. So as Ledger mentioned, we live in Alabama. And I love our state, but a lot of times we can be slow to embrace change. And so I'm not a futurist, but I like to pretend like I am one. And so I'm always kind of looking around the horizon, what's coming. And I guess 3 years ago, I was doing a lot of reading and came across a few pieces of technology and thought, man, if this stuff really happens, Alabama is going to be a world of hurt. And so as I did more research, I was like, I need to develop a speech on this. And so I developed a speech. I guess this was in 2015. I think it was 15, if it was not 16. Anyway, in that area where I pulled four pieces of technology, talked about Internet of Things, talked about 3D printing, autonomous vehicles, and blockchain. And so I developed a talk where the audience, if they listened, you know, good enough, they could walk away really understanding those four pieces of technology.
So you're addressing like local business leaders.
That's exactly right. It was a Rotary group at first, and then people, it was well received. So I gave that speech about 6 or 7 times, and I used it and really focused on autonomous vehicles and how that has a potential of upending an automobile industry that we have here in Alabama.
Yeah, the trucking industry, I think, is the largest in the state, along with, I think, 20 or 30 other states in the U.S.
Yeah. But specifically the automobile manufacturing that we have here.
I see.
Because we've become the Detroit of the South over the past 20 years, which is great. But if you all of a sudden switch eventually to autonomous fleets where, you know, you don't actually own your car, you're subscribing to a service and one car can do what 10 cars could do, then eventually the aggregate demand for automobiles in the United States goes down and all those jobs that we have in here, Alabama, are in jeopardy.
I see.
And I think that'll eventually happen. So it's more of a wake up, guys, pay attention, learn about these technologies, and then we need to think differently. So each time I gave that speech, I checked and referenced the price of Bitcoin because I was talking about blockchain. And at first it was 200, then it was 300 and 500. And I think Mt. Gox maybe happened or something happened and the price went back down. And eventually the last time I gave that speech, Bitcoin was at $900. And it just then occurred to me, hey, you should really look at this and consider buying some.
So you watched this whole run without having a dollar in it.
It did not even dawn on me to buy any. And I don't know why, but it finally did. And so I bought some Bitcoin, not much at all, not enough, but I bought some Bitcoin at like $900 and then started, you know, investing more and more. And then, you know, then I discovered the internet's deepest rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And really fell down it.
So how long ago was it that you really started getting more in depth in terms of what you're trying to invest in?
That would have been, I guess, I mean, I've been in depth, let's just say, for the past 15 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were able to at least observe that huge run up back up from 1,000.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
So then you kind of assume, at least based on our conversations, you kind of increased your involvement in you know, what you were looking at and researching and digging into this rabbit hole throughout 2017, basically.
That's exactly right. You know, and then we get into this, but I attended BlockCon in Los Angeles, I went to Bitcoin Miami a few months ago, or a couple months ago now, and really, you know, had no idea how a real estate guy would be accepted at a conference. You know, all the conferences I've ever really been to are real estate, you know, conferences, and they're usually very boring and stuffy, and this was anything but, which was nice.
So let's get into your background in real estate and how you're using that to apply thinking towards this space. You are a partner at a real estate firm locally, and y'all do commercial real estate. What if you had to like do the short version of your day to day as a real business person? What is that?
Well, so I guess quick background on my firm. We it's called Shannon Walchek, and we own a portfolio of around $220 million worth of real estate with investors. The portfolio is predominantly in the Southeast, or it's actually all in the Southeast. Predominantly in Alabama. It's shopping centers and office buildings. And then we were responsible for another $100 million worth of real estate that we manage for other people. So third party work.
Okay.
So we're a full service brokerage shop, which means when you eventually, you know, expand your empire and you want to find office space, we can help you do that or buy a building. We can do that as well. So that's the background. We're a little bit different than your average commercial real estate firm in that we actually own a bunch of real estate. Mm-hmm. And that's what we love. Our tagline is we love real estate. Okay. We had that before UPS love logistics. so we're real estate nerds and we love it.
You manage the properties and you kind of do full service of all things real estate on behalf of someone that brings you some amount of money and they just want someone to manage it. And you essentially deliver a return.
Yeah, what you just described would really be like the third party work.
Okay.
But like for the deals that we put together, you know, we'll raise equity for, let's just say there's a shopping center we like a lot. We'll raise equity and we'll be partners with them.
Okay.
In the deal where we manage the property, we manage the investment, we do quarterly distributions, and then eventually when the time is right, we'll sell the asset.
Okay. So is this wrong to look at that in the sense of like, it's almost as if you're going to a like niche hedge fund in a way, like in terms of someone wanting to gain exposure to a certain sector? So like if there was you could almost have a company like this that was doing the same thing for crypto, right?
You could. Yeah, you could. And,
hedge fund's not the right word because most hedge funds are just really looking for any investment.
That's right. But yeah, you could do the same model, we could adopt the exact same model, take in, equity from investors and go invest in crypto investments.
The reason I ask that is because I have to wonder, like, do you put the same type of hat on when you're analyzing possible investments in crypto that you use in the real estate world?
Yeah, you do. I would, although I don't nearly have as much depth of knowledge as I do in real estate that I do in crypto. So I would not feel comfortable.
I mean, in crypto that you do in real estate.
Yes. I would
not to get any of his real estate investors worried.
That's right. Yeah, we've had a pretty good track record in real estate, but yeah, I wouldn't say I'm ready to take investors' money and you know, put it in crypto yet.
Sure. But that kind of full service investment model is the type of thing that you do, but for real estate. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. I mean, just in a nutshell, we provide an investment opportunity for, you know, a middle class guy who's really, you know, all his really only options to invest would be in the stock market and bonds, mutual funds. And he could take $25,000-$50,000 and put it in a deal on a shopping center that's around the corner from where he lives and produce a really steady return.
Okay. So you are even addressing what I would call like a retail investor with something like that.
Sort of.
Yeah. Quasi-retail investor.
Yeah.
Cool. So when you're, well, I guess what took you from, okay, I'm going to buy some Bitcoin to now there's this whole ICO market that's going on and I want exposure to that as well.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just the natural progression that people invest in crypto. You know, they put some money in Coinbase, you know, they buy Bitcoin, then maybe they buy some Litecoin and some Ethereum. And then, you know, it's like, hey, what are all these other, you know, these other coins and these other things on Bittrex and Poloniex, et cetera.
Did you go that route first and just say, well, I'm just going to buy some of the ones that are already listed?
Yep.
And then you evolved even further down.
That's right. I did. You know, I mean, I spent probably at least 1,000 hours last year studying, reading, learning, listening, you know, and then, you know, experience is the best teacher, you know, made a bunch of money, lost a bunch of money, but learned good lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And also make good contacts within the industry. I've been surprised with how easy people are to reach out to and they respond. That's been really fun.
Can you give an example of that? Because it doesn't have to be a specific person, but like,
sure.
What made you even think like, okay, well, here's a team that's involved in a project or something. I'm going to, you know, shoot them an email. Like, and what's that process been like for you when you engage with either a project team or like another investor where you're trying to get advice?
I mean, and I don't want to mention names. Maybe I'll mention a couple because I don't want them to get inundated. But like, for instance, one of my first guys that I really respected a lot was Ari Paul. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to Ari, having no idea if he would respond, but he did. And we had multiple emails back and forth where he was open to answering questions. It was great. And then I think that kind of emboldened me. I went to BlockCon in Los Angeles, met Jimmy Song, spent some time talking to him. Now he's a friend. Same with Tone Vase. And so these people, you know, quite frankly, I guess, I think you said this last week that some of these people that you see as crypto celebrities, they weren't celebrities a year or two ago. So they're still easy to get to know. But it's great to have those contacts because you can bounce ideas off of them and you can say, you know, what, this is kind of how I'm seeing this deal. Am I off base or am I on base? How do you see this? It's been a thrill.
And today, you've got kind of a diversified portfolio, if you will, where you're trying to look at the landscape in a lot of ways. So you're traditional investments, like somebody like me would, you know, some kind of mixed portfolio of assets, but then you've got some capital that you're actively engaging in ICO opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I want to understand how you view the ICO landscape in terms of its maturity and its weaknesses, I guess. Mm-hmm. Let's start there.
So, it's topsy-turvy at the moment, you know. A true ICO, you know, an American's probably not going to be able to invest unless it's a true token. And what is that anymore? You know, what is a real token that's utility token that is? Yeah,
either a utility token or they call a spade a spade and it's a security token and then access is extremely limited and it's not going to be traded anymore.
Or you're going to have to wait for T0 or for, you know, the other exchanges that you can trade securities on.
Right. But right now, like say some, I was just listening, What Bitcoin Did is another podcast and he does a great job. He was interviewing, I think, the Science VC firm founder, and I think they have a security token where it's literally, you know, it's like, it is like buying stock, but it can't be listed and it won't be listed for years probably. So people that can invest in something like that, like a fund or something like that where it is tokenized, it's a whole different world than what we're talking about. Like, so, you know, someone does an ICO and then you're expecting it to be, you know, put onto, you know, some small exchange and then get on Binance or whatever soon after so that you can have that instant liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
These are totally different worlds. And right now, in terms of US investors, you can really only invest in one like that, where it might end up on one of those exchanges, if it's a proper utility token.
Or you're, and I think this is the opportunity right now, you know, because of all the fear of regulation, what the SEC has said, where they said essentially they haven't seen an ICO that's not a security.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty scary thing, statement to make.
Yeah.
So then, you know, then the answer for, a group trying to raise equity from Americans is, you know, you only raise equity from accredited investors, and maybe you don't even do the ICO. It's just simply you raise private money. So when I heard that and saw that, I said, okay, there's a real opportunity here. If you are accredited, which I am, to go get to these people first, and invest in the basically you beat everybody else to the punch. And
so this is in the private sale and the pre-sale range.
That's right.
And for a lot of projects, this is before someone like me would even really know what they are, that they exist. Like a lot of these are pretty under the radar at that stage, right?
That's right.
So how do you do the same type of due diligence? Because if I was going to say, hey, I want to invest in an ICO, this looks great. And, you know, I've done that with several that I never pulled the trigger on, or really the only one I ever actually tried to pull the trigger on the, I didn't have enough gas on the transaction, so it failed, and then it sold out, and then I didn't get it. So I've never invested in ICOs to date. Yeah.
Okay.
Not directly. And now they've closed it down. My only method of doing so really is over the counter or once it hits the exchange. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, like, how do you do due diligence on projects that sometimes don't have a lot to show for it?
Well, just because it's not in a ICO format where you can go on the website and see everything.
Doesn't have all the default marketing stuff.
That doesn't mean anything. I mean, it may be a much better baked project that actually has working product. And
but how do you even learn that it exists?
Well, that's where you have to network, and you have to have lots of connections with other investors who are doing the same thing you are. So if you can, because there's a pack of people, there's a pack of hedge funds that travel together, and a lot of times they'll do the same deals. So if you can get to know those people, one or two friends within those companies, then you can start to kind of see some deal flow. And then eventually you kind of work yourself into a spot where you're kind of co-investing with them.
Okay. Would you say that you're addressing the space like you're an angel fund investor in a way? So that, are you expecting the majority of what you invest in to fail?
No.
Okay.
If deep down, no.
You don't ever want to see that.
Intellectually, maybe you kind of expect some to fail. But there's so many, and so many of them are just they're flawed for whatever reason. They're either a scam, or they're just too broad, or they don't have the real tech and they're an idea. But I think, there's telltale signs for the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, a lot of times, and this is something that happens in Silicon Valley, where your first question is, well, who else is investing?
Mm-hmm.
You need
the lead investor to be able to then go to market, essentially.
Well, the lead investor then tells you that they assuming that they've done their due diligence, and you can kind of piggyback off of them.
So would you say it's you're looking at it in terms of risk models more like if you were a venture capital firm? Because a lot of venture capital firms, at least when the companies out there aren't... People want your money, and you're not having to go find places to give money.
Right.
Venture capitalists can be a little more picky, and they have to, an entrepreneur going to them has to give a good pitch and have a real business plan, all these things. And even in that scenario, a good number fail. The added advantage that we have, I guess, in this market is the liquidity.
That's exactly right.
So is that essentially the way you're looking at it in terms of risking?
Yes. I mean, really what it is, it's regardless of its blockchain or whatever, it is angel investing with early liquidity.
Okay.
I mean, that's what this market is.
Do you think that's what is making this industry appealing for a lot of investors is the liquidity?
Absolutely.
So where they're most...
The assumption that there will be liquidity when they need it, which that may or may not be true.
Yeah.
And at different times, it's not true.
Yeah. So we don't really know yet, I guess, how liquid the market is. Because part of me wonders, so an early investor finds out, I'm ready to de-risk myself of this investment. It looks like it's going south. I wonder how transparent that is to everyone else that, that may need liquidity. And if you can essentially create a crash scenario for some of these projects where they're just clearly losing it, or if it's a little slower than that.
Well, I think in times of stress, I'm sure we'll see that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we've seen it really yet.
Yeah. What we're seeing so far is a lot of times a project comes out of the ICO and it's instantly worth 2x, 3x, 10x. We've seen projects 100x their USD values.
But those are rare.
Short amount of time. I know, but a lot of them, most projects that I see where I would even sniff at them in terms of me buying them on a secondary market, they're nowhere close to their ICO price, much less a pre-sale price.
Yep.
And that gives potential investors a lot of protection.
Mm-hmm.
So part of me naturally wonders how overextended are we in that regard, where people are a little looser with the initial investment just because of this history of stuff pretty simply for a project that's, not awful above its ICO price, essentially giving protection to possible investors. And I'm just wondering how, if you're looking at risks that way.
Yes, I think you need to pick up, I guess the way I would look at it would be, you're picking a project that has a low market cap, that has a hard cap that sits relatively low, like Switchio.
Yeah.
Which I think
we have an interview coming up with the Switchio team, and this gets into the whole idea of what we're trying to do here.
Yeah.
So I'm introducing Derek today, but we're going to be talking to some of the teams, whether he has deal interest in them or not, just people that we think are doing something interesting.
Yeah. So we're going to talk to Ivan Poon with Switchio. And so in Switchio, and we'll learn it's a Neo or a NEP5 token DEX that'll be first to market. And I think they're raising their hard caps $8.7 million. So I think they'll have clear field for 2 to 3 months or maybe 4 months before Nex comes out. I think there's another DEX that will be coming, a Neo DEX, but
essentially there's a turf war for who's going to be the dominant Neo-based decentralized exchange, the way we saw or have seen mm-hmm. the previous round of this with Ethereum tokens and them having these quick listings through all these different.
Yeah, when the initial Ethereum tokens first come out.
Yeah, where do you go to get that liquidity started?
Sort of like Ether Delta has been, where the tokens go first. And so so this team is not only going to be working on Neo, but they're going to be trying to become a DEX for Qtum and other other chains that don't have DEXs yet. So I think it's a no-brainer. Mm-hmm. You know, $8.7 million, it's low. The token makes a lot of sense, and so I was able to invest early with that, and I think that will work. Of course, so famous last words.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, none of this is investment advice for anyone else, but
that's
how you're approaching
a
project. So you see a project like that, it fits your criteria for you seeing a market, there's liquidity available with them, that's mm-hmm. they're going to be able to create liquidity through their own product, mm-hmm. which is interesting. So essentially they have to have that product to succeed and be viable.
Right.
Where do you go from there? Like when you're at, let's say you invest in something and okay, this is great. There's this benefit of liquidity. I know sometimes if someone's invested publicly in a project, they actually have lockup periods. Mm-hmm. What do the negotiations look like when you're talking to teams in regards to how long you'll keep the tokens and essentially getting an allotment from them?
Yeah, I'm not a big enough fish to have to deal with lockups. You need to be a pretty big or a big percentage of the deal to be faced with a lockup period.
So they don't want somebody that is a listed investor to essentially dump all over the retail.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I'm not anywhere near big enough, at least at this point, to have to deal with that.
But that's something that some of these investors, mm-hmm. they get a good deal, maybe even a better deal, because I'm sure there's stages of resale pricing.
Like I won't mention the ICO, but there's an upcoming ICO that I was able to get in early. And the bar for you, basically the number value where you had to deal with a lockup period was $1 million or more investment.
Yeah. So in a single project, it's a significant amount of money.
That's right.
You're really leaving those types of investments to either someone that's a very true believer.
or these crypto hedge funds that travel together as packs and do that. But they don't like lockups either. So, it's a negotiation.
Everybody likes liquidity.
That's right.
how do you look at it in terms of, okay, well, I see this as something that's got a great future. Mm-hmm. And 5 years from now, I feel like this could be, top 100 market cap, blah, blah, blah.
So my pitch usually is, they can raise equity. They can raise money. That's pretty
easy. Not struggling to hit those market caps.
No, they want to find a strategic partner that does something more than just brings them cash. And so going back in time a little bit, I was an early investor in Zcoin. And so my pitch to Zcoin was, look, I'm doing these talks, these crypto talks. My talks have evolved into crypto talks here in Alabama, where just explaining what Bitcoin is and blockchain, et cetera. And so I've worked Zcoin into that talk where, I explain what a privacy coin is, why it's important, why it's not for drugs or for, illicit activity.
But not necessarily.
Yeah. But it's a really needed, it's a needed function. If you're in medical records or you're buying things, there's a lot of reasons why good, straight, normal people need to have privacy in the things that they purchase.
For the same reason that, I don't want every transaction that goes through my debit and checking account.
Exactly.
To be public on the blockchain.
Yeah. So I've worked Zcoin into that. And we've done some Zcoin giveaways. And so my pitch to some of these teams is, look, I'm going to sort of be a mouthpiece for you. Mm-hmm. And be an advocate and, raise your awareness through social media, et cetera, in projects that I believe in.
And they're, I guess that appeals to them even when, for the most part, you're talking, until I yanked you into this project, for the most part, they're asking for that in a local audience and they see value there.
That's right. That's right.
Do you think that the whole idea of blockchain and crypto is is it sinking in for local audiences when you talk to, you know, a group in Birmingham, Alabama?
You know, it's interesting. You can tell if I've done it right and the talk worked, which that happens hopefully more than it doesn't, is people kind of leave just like bleary eyed and they're kind of like, whoa, my head is spinning. Mm-hmm. You know, they can see the future. Their mind is blown. They're still dealing with what they heard, and they go away just kind of like, wow. You know, almost like they're changed a little bit. I usually start my talk, though, and I'll poll the audience and I'll say, raise your hand if you have a generally favorable view of Bitcoin. Just, you know, you can define that however you want to, and raise your hand if you have a general unfavorable view of Bitcoin. And I've been amazed that, like, my audiences have been running about 20% favorable and then 80% are unfavorable. For whatever reason, they don't like it. You know, mm-hmm. And we actually talked
about this. This isn't always like old people or whatever.
No.
Very limited understanding of things like in terms of technology. This is a normal young audience.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it skews a little older. But yeah, and I think it's because the
but it's a typical demographic.
Yes, it would be. So I think we still have a lot of work to do
in terms of people understanding that Bitcoin's not just for buying drugs on Silk Road.
Yes, or for, you know, if your computer gets hijacked and you have to pay ransom.
That's the only way you pay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of it as well.
In terms of what you're hoping to get out of all of this, mm-hmm. I mean, all of us are here to make money, obviously.
Right.
What else are you looking at? Like, what's motivated you to, say, spend 1,000 hours over the course of a year learning about an industry when you got other stuff to do? You got a family, you got a business to run, all that kind of stuff. So
yes.
What's motivated you to dig in?
I think making money is number one. I think, again, that's what you said.
It's everybody's first incentive.
Yeah, we're all in this to do that.
And that's the whole idea of incentivizing stuff in this ecosystem.
That's right. So it's to make money. It's to have a front row seat to see opportunities, you know, and hopefully to find some life-changing companies that you can invest in or blockchains. The other reason, selfishly, for commercial real estate is I think that they're...
You went right into where I was wanting to go.
Okay, good. It's like we talked about this. So with commercial real estate, I think our industry has not been, disrupted, quite frankly, by much of anything. It's still kind of done the same way. And so I do believe that we're not unique and eventually we will be disrupted by technology. And so I think that will probably take the form of some sort of blockchain that will disrupt our industry. And so I want to have a front row seat to see when the technology is ready mm-hmm. to disrupt commercial real estate. And so that may be, you know, through recording deeds, maybe through through property conveyance, you know, or eventually it'll be tokenizing, you know, real estate assets.
There's obviously been real estate projects, and mm-hmm. for the most part, you've had limited or no exposure.
Yeah, I haven't.
Is it interesting to you to know about an industry and then see people trying to apply a spin for that industry in crypto and identify the gap? Like, is there a big gap and what is it?
I think, if you have firsthand knowledge of an industry and then you couple that with like some different ICOs and you look at it and you're like, that is crap.
Yeah.
You
know, because it's not connecting.
It makes no sense, or it's overly broad and therefore it's not going to be good at anything.
And this isn't to say there's like no good real estate project out there, but
it's not out there yet.
Yeah. You haven't seen one that's really hit the nail on the head yet.
No.
Okay.
I haven't. I think it'll come. I do. But I think most of what's out there is not good.
Does it give you skepticism in terms of looking at other industry-specific ICOs?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you're like, okay, I really understand commercial real estate, and I'm looking at the real estate ICOs. And so if the rest of the market is like this, then you really start to believe what everybody says, which is 90 to 95% of ICOs will go away.
Yeah. So when you are looking at a project, I assume you're looking for maybe principally, if it's not like... If the project's not built for crypto, like, you know, you just use the example of a DEX, like it's built for crypto, so their knowledge base has alignment.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say it's industry specific, okay? So the blockchain that they're talking about, bringing blockchain to the Internet of Things or whatever. Is it important to you that they come from the industry around the Internet of Things or whatever?
Yes. Either that they come from it or they have experts who are advising the project or are closely associated with them that understand it. I mean, if you're not in the industry, you're not really going to be able to understand how to.
Yeah. The reason I ask is most projects I've seen, and I've been, you know, actively looking for what are some things that are the same thing. Like, I want to catch the a company that's doing good stuff early before it blows up. And a lot of times I see a gap in one of two directions. Direction number one is these are just people that are doing stuff in blockchain. They're maybe great blockchain developers, but they don't know anything about the industry they're in. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I lean to that being a better option because they might be able to actually launch a blockchain and then get, you know, figure out the industry. Yeah. The other route that I've seen a lot of, and it gives me concern for another reason, is people that are from an industry. They've built some product or have something specific in that industry, but they don't know the first thing about the blockchain world. Mm-hmm. And they've essentially created a spinoff from their company to go tackle that.
Right.
It seems like you've been drawn to at least some of those. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some projects that you've invested in that that you've told me about. What do you have concerns about the centralized nature of a project like that? Because I think some of my audience is probably going to be more like traditional crypto.
Yes.
I don't want to invest in something that it's totally reliant on that company and all that kind of stuff. Super centralized organizational thing.
Right. This may make your audience mad, and that's okay. but I think that, again, let's go back to what I said. I think we're really dealing with this is angel investing with early liquidity, right? I think that is a lens through which you can look at the ICO and crypto. And so, you know, the roots of what we're part of is decentralized, where, you know, there's not a central point of failure, immutable, et cetera, which is all great. That is what you want in a blockchain. However, I do think that things can pop up, in this industry where there's really good products or it's a good solution for a problem that may just stay centralized. And that does not mean that you won't make money investing in that and that product won't be successful.
Do you think there's a potential, reckoning of sorts in the future for a lot of these where they're raising funds and creating the initial product on the value of the network, whereas really a lot of investors are looking for value in the
company
and blockchain application, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So
I heard it described as a non-dilutive capital raise.
Okay.
It's basically what, you know, what people are able to do with this, with blockchain and ICOs. You know, it's non-dilutive to the actual profits of the company.
So I've said this for a while, and it seems to me like this space will be healthier when we call a spade.
I know.
And we just say like, okay, well, this company is raising money and now accredited investors can invest in it. And here you go. And that essentially squeezes out the retail investor.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that's healthier for building quality blockchain applications? Or do you think, should we be trying harder essentially to keep decentralized networks for these various specific applications of blockchain?
Time will tell. I don't know.
So that's a big question.
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I think time will tell. You know, you can start a movement with certain core tenets, and over time, those core tenets can shift, you know, based on just the reality of what works, what doesn't work.
Yeah, I wonder if that's if there's a path for some of these that have already been, they're already out there, but they're essentially basing their valuation on this network, and can they essentially shift, or is there like a token swap or something in the futures where it's like, okay, well now this is just a security because the SEC told us, and now the network is going to be different, and like,
right,
we're going to change all of this and survive somehow.
Yeah. I don't know.
To me, that's like the scariest thing about investing in this.
Yes.
In this landscape, whether it's even over the counter after the fact, you know, like buying something on an exchange, that's the biggest thing that worries me personally, that we don't know what we're buying.
You know, the other scary thing is that I don't want to say it's the lie we tell ourselves, but it's kind of always in the back of our mind, is that because there's liquidity, instant liquidity, we tell ourselves, or at least that's what I'm telling myself, is, yeah, that might happen, but I can sell before that happens.
Yeah.
You know, and
until the announcement comes down.
Exactly. And that very well may not be true. And that's sort of a scary underlying assumption that everybody's making.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think you will have a day of reckoning coming at some point.
Let's finish back on real estate and blockchain, because I think it's just interesting.
Okay.
You talked about how the solutions you've seen are either an ill-equipped team or they're overly broad because they don't really understand the ecosystem. And you mentioned a few phrases of the type of things that could go on the blockchain and real estate. I don't know what those are. You know, like, when I think of it, I'm like, okay, well, I should be able to go see, you know, chain analysis on Zillow's website. Like, that's the way I view what real estate on the blockchain makes sense. That's essentially tokenizing my house and your house and everybody else's house and
right.
get the tax records, all that stuff in there. That's the overly broad scenario, I guess.
No, I guess like, I don't want to call out specific, real estate tokens or chains.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say overly broad, like...
They just want to be everything in.
I want to call out specifics, but I'm not going to. they're just trying to do too much. Like, it was funny. I guess 9 months ago, I was approached by a real estate blockchain company that was going to have an ICO. And I was really flattered. I was like, they want me to be an advisor. This is awesome. I was mm-hmm. like, send me your stuff. I want to read it. And I read the first two pages. Then I was just kind of crestfallen because it was like, they're trying to raise $70 million and they don't know
what they're doing
at all. I'm like, I'm not going to be associated with this.
But there are obvious, as you said, that there are parts of the real estate process
yes.
that benefit greatly from a public blockchain.
So if anybody is really interested in this area of blockchain, there's a guy named Ragnar Leifthreis.
Okay.
And we can maybe...
We're going to have to link that up.
Yeah, we'll link it. But of anybody in commercial real estate / blockchain, he probably knows more about it than anybody else. He's a guy in California. I actually spent 45 minutes with him on Skype last week just talking and learning from him. I think, like I said, you've got one potential use of blockchain for commercial real estate is to record deeds. So when you go buy a house, you receive a deed from the seller,
mm-hmm.
and then typically you will take that deed and go record it in a courthouse, and it'll go into a file at the judge of probate's office. And then eventually when, you go to sell the property, you'll order title, and then the title company will then go research and see your title all the way back to, the beginning of time, and know that you have good title. By looking at that, that stuff can be stored on a blockchain. No
so that's
problem.
The immutability of your title, essentially.
Yes. But that involves government.
Yeah. Changing. You just talked about a lot of different entities that have to get there.
That's right. So government would have to see that this is a less expensive way to keep records, essentially. But then it's still centralized. In a sense, because the government's,
the government's got a say in it.
Yeah, exactly. And then is it immutable? I mean, but that's one area in the conveyance of real estate where you actually, when you give the deed, I go buy your house and you write a deed and you give it to me, you've just conveyed me the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
That can be done using blockchain. And that actually has happened a time or two already
mm-hmm.
where property's been conveyed. And then eventually, I think you'll have tokenization of the actual ownership of assets. And so my dream one day is that you can take your iPhone or whatever phone
or Android.
That's right. You take your phone and you go to a shopping center that's around the corner from your house. And there's a QR code on a sign. You scan it. You then pull up the property records. So you see the tenants, who they are, how long they've been there, how long they are staying based on the rent roll. You then can look at the annual net operating income, and you can look at the quarterly distributions that the property's been spending off. And then right then and there, you can actually buy tokens that own that property. And so you can invest in that real estate asset just standing there in the parking lot with your phone.
And what you're doing there is you really are adding liquidity and to anything.
Yes.
To any piece of real estate, if someone's willing to sell it, then... They're essentially making it known
mm-hmm.
very easily. Or when they enter the agreement, like that's part of the deal.
That's right.
That's how you do it.
That's right. And so my purpose, a big part of the reason I'm in this world and spend a lot of time is to have a front row seat to be able to see eventually when that's going to happen and then to be involved with it.
So you're going to be here for a while.
I think so.
cool. Yeah. Well, and to get back to kind of our original premise, is one, I just think talking to you in this format is interesting and but what we're going to do is we're going to do our best to bring the type of conversations you have before you invest in a project.
Mm-hmm.
So in the negotiation stage or like the pitch stage of pre-ICO conversations. And we're going to try to bring that type of conversation to the air and mm-hmm. talk to some projects.
That's right.
You may be invested in some of them. You won't be invested in all of them.
That's right.
I'll do my best to like snag some. But finding these companies and that kind of thing is a challenge. And I really want to be able to open up this process some to our audience that surely is interested in how this whole ecosystem is working.
Yes.
And so we're gonna aim to interview some of these people and have those types of conversations. Obviously, your value there is that you do this. Like this is part of your everyday investing strategy.
Yeah. And so what I want to do is find interesting people and interesting projects.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the same team that everybody's interviewing, having the exact same interview, tell me your hard cap, your token lockup period, et cetera, et cetera.
And that's what there is out there a good bit, right?
Yes, now. I think so. So trying to find the personalities, the team, to try to give a sense of the person and the people if we can. Mm-hmm. You know, that's hard sometimes because you have a language barrier, but really trying to figure out who's who and what's what. And
then after we talk to these people, we'll typically try to do like a post game, essentially.
That's right.
And say, well, either I already did invest in this, or I would probably pass on this.
Or they were terrible.
Yeah.
This run. Don't walk.
Yeah. So we're going to try to be as real as we can, I guess, in terms of giving our lay of the land based on the conversation we had. So that's our aim. If people want to keep track of what you've got going on, where do they do that?
Yeah. So probably follow me on Twitter is the easiest. At DWalchak, DWALTCHACK.
And I'll link that up as well in the show notes. And y'all should see us soon on an interview with some project. And going forward, we'll see how often we can wrangle these, but it should be fun.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, it's good having you on and good talking to you. Y'all have a good one.
Monuments crumble in the blink of an eye. The easy river has just run dry. In a house of cards, I feel the breeze wound so tight, I can barely breathe.